All right, we got through nine slides last time. Slide 10 isn't really too much new information. It's just showing you that since meiosis randomly chooses one allele or the other from a diploid cell to make a haploid gamete, and since there is an equal chance of either one being picked, it's exactly analogous to flipping a fair coin, meaning that there's a one-half chance for a head, one-half chance for a tail. That's like picking either gamete. And therefore, any individual zygote in a Punnett square has a chance, probabilistically speaking, that's equal to the mathematical product of the probabilities of those gametes being chosen, which is half times half, 0.5 times 0.5, which is 0.25, one quarter. So it just shows you that you can think of this purely probabilistically rather than just biologically. And that ends the part of the chapter that is about so-called Mendelian genetics. Mendelian genetics is named in his honor, of course, in Mendel's honor. But not all genetics works in a Mendelian fashion. So all of those important ratios that we've been talking about, those occur only when you have Mendelian genetics operating. That's true only if there are a couple important requirements that are met. In other words, we're talking about Mendelian genetics only if a couple things are true. And those things that must be true for Mendelian genetics to work are, one, that for whatever characteristic you're studying, or gene, you can think there's a correspondence between characteristic and gene, like I said. For any given characteristic, there's exactly two traits possible in the population. But correspondingly, another way you could say that is for any given gene that you're studying, there are exactly two alleles possible in the population. And that's been true up to now. Everything we've talked about, there were just two possibilities, right? Purple flowers, white flowers, and that's it. That's only one thing that has to be true, though, that both of these things have to be true. The other thing is that one of the two alleles that are possible has to completely dominate over the other. And what I mean by complete dominance is that it requires only one or more, but one at least, dominant allele to give the organism fully the dominant trait, the dominant phenotype, which is what we saw, right? The purple-flowered individuals in the F1 generation were just as purple as the true breeding purple-flowered parent was, because that's complete dominance. Okay, so if both of those things are true, then you have Mendelian genetics, and regardless of what kind of characteristic you're talking about, you're going to have those familiar ratios we were talking about. That brings us up to where we are now. The rest of the chapter, most of the rest of the chapter, is about non-Mendelian genetics, which is the situation when one or more of those two requirements are not met, and therefore things don't happen the same way as we've been studying. And this is why I said Mendel might have gotten lucky in his choices, because if he had chosen things that for which those assumptions are not met, it would have been a hell of a lot harder for him to figure things out mathematically, especially having no knowledge of the molecules involved. But let's talk about some exceptions to Mendelian genetics. The rest of this is non-Mendelian, starting with slide 11. And this category of exception is called incomplete dominance. Now, that name just by itself should tell you it's an exception to Mendelian genetics, because I just got done telling you that one of the requirements for Mendelian genetics is that you have complete dominance. Incomplete is obviously not complete. So there is a dominance here, meaning that one allele is dominant over the other, and the red, in this case, red flower color allele, is dominant over the white allele. But it's not complete dominance. And therefore, what we have here is a familiar situation of a single characteristic, flower color, and one of the Mendelian requirements is met. You have exactly two possible alleles in the population. There's only two alleles, red and white. But because you don't have complete dominance over the other, you don't have just two phenotypes possible, like in the purple and white flower pea plant example. In these flowers, there's three possible phenotypes, right? White, pink, and red. And that's because for incomplete dominance, a heterozygous individual, which of course by definition has just one dominant allele, has the dominant phenotype, but not fully, not as fully as a homozygous dominant individual has. In other words, having just one dominant allele gets you partly toward that dominant phenotype, but not fully. So partly red is pink in this case. And if you think about how genes work, which we've been studying in previous chapters, this should make sense, right? Because genes are just instructions for how to make mRNA. mRNA then are instructions for how to build proteins. If you are a homozygous dominant individual, you have two duplicate DNA genes, right? So in the same amount of time, you are able to transcribe twice as much mRNA if you use both of those genes, right? And if you have twice as many mRNA molecules, then when it comes time to translation, you can, in the same amount of time, make twice as much polypeptide, which is what gives you the trait. So for certain genes, making twice as much protein actually gives you a bigger dose of the phenotype. For some, it doesn't matter. Like in the pea plant flower color example, it didn't matter. But here it does, and that's incomplete dominance. Okay. Slide 12 actually does double duty, because this example is two different exceptions to Mendelian genetics, and they don't have anything to do with each other, but it represents both of them. Both of them is true for this example. The example uses human blood grouping. Now, there are all kinds of blood groups for humans, dozens of different ones, but most people don't know anything about most of those blood groups because they're not a big deal clinically. Most humans are aware of two major blood groups because they are so clinically important, meaning if you're not careful, you can kill someone by transfusing the wrong blood. And those two important ones are the ABO blood group and the RH group. And since those are the two biggies, we often just give a shorthand result for both of these, even though the RH group has nothing to do with the ABO group. Like if a person says that I'm type B negative, that really just means in the ABO group, I'm B. In the RH group, which has nothing to do with ABO, I'm negative. It just gives the results of one. And we're not looking at RH group here at all, only the ABO group. But ABO blood typing has to do with antibodies and antigens. An antibody, like we've already talked about a little bit in this course, is a protein important in immunity, a protein that an organism makes that, because of its particular shape, is able to recognize a particular shape of some foreign thing, meaning non-part of that organism, that has the corresponding shape. And those things that antibodies are able to recognize are called antigens. Well, in red blood cells, or on red blood cells, on the surface of red blood cells, antigens are placed in an organism, represented by these triangles and circles. So the antigens are the things that can be recognized by antibodies. Now, a person that has A antigens would not want to have antibodies that recognize A antigens, right? Otherwise, that person's own blood would attack his own blood. The antibodies are in the plasma, which is the liquid portion of the blood that's outside of the red blood cells. The cells themselves have the antigens. And so a type A person has A antigens on the cells, and the plasma has anti-B antibodies, not anti-A. And conversely, a type B person produces B antigens, but anti-A antibodies, so that it can recognize A as foreign blood. AB has both kinds of antigens, and therefore neither kind of antibody. And a type O has neither antigen, and therefore both kinds of antibodies. Well, that's just clinically how things work, but as far as genetics is concerned, this is an exception to Mendelian genetics for one reason, because it's an example of a category called multiple alleles. So I just told you a little bit ago that one of the requirements for it to be Mendelian is that there have to be exactly two alleles. So the word multiple here doesn't mean more than one, it means more than two. Okay, if it's three or more, then obviously you don't have exactly two, and therefore it's not Mendelian. In this case, there are three alleles in the population for the antigens that get placed on red blood cells. The I's here stand for immunoglobulin, which is another name for an antibody. But anyway, a type A person produces A antigens. Type A allele gives rise to A antigens. The type B allele produces B antigens. And type O, which is just an I by itself, produces neither. So when you have multiple alleles, then you don't have those familiar ratios that I was talking about. And the figuring out your results when you're dealing with a big sample size like Mendel is much more difficult. So that's one reason that it's an exception. Another reason, independent of that, but also represented by this example, is a category called codominance. And be careful with the phrases incomplete dominance and codominance because of the similarity. They're not the same thing, but obviously they both deal with some sort of dominance. We just covered incomplete dominance. That was the pink-flowered one, red, pink, or white. In codominance, co meaning share, there are two alleles of however many alleles there are. Two alleles aren't dominant. Neither one is dominant over the other. Now, they can both be dominant to a third allele, and that's what's happening here. All right, so the A allele is dominant over the O allele. The B allele is dominant over the O allele, which is why there's two ways to become type A, either AA or AO. A is dominant over O, similarly for B. But A is not dominant over B, and B is not dominant over A. Instead, those two are codominant. And what the result of codominance is that instead of having one phenotype or the other corresponding to one of the two alleles, the individual will simultaneously exhibit both phenotypes fully. What that means in this specific example is that a type AB person, having one of each of these two codominant alleles, is going to be just as much a type A person as a fully type A person, and simultaneously just as much a type B person as a fully type B person. Both phenotypes are fully expressed simultaneously in codominance. All right? Two different exceptions there. Let's go to 13 now. Look at these rats. Now, how many characteristics are we dealing with here? What is the characteristic?
One. fur color?
Correct, fur color. So there's one characteristic. Now look at the, just ignore the Punnett square for a minute. Just look at the top row. Look at those genotypes. What's unusual about that compared to what we have been doing when we pay attention to one characteristic? There's two genotypes. Well, it's all one genotype, but there's two types of letters here, right? There's B's and C's. What does that mean molecularly? When you have two different symbols in a genotype, two different types of symbols. What are you dealing with? What does B represent? And I'm not talking about specifically an uppercase or a lowercase. I just mean a B. What does B represent molecularly?
Allele?
No, an uppercase B or a lowercase B represent an allele. B, the category, represents a gene. Okay? So what I was asking is that since you have two different types of symbols here, a B and a C, we're dealing with two genes, even though we're dealing with one characteristic. And we haven't had this before, right? Okay, this is a special kind of gene interaction called epistasis. What I mean by epistasis is that the product of one of the two genes, which is the protein that's eventually produced after the gene gets transcribed and then the RNA gets translated, that gene product of the one gene, the protein, controls whether or not the second gene gets transcribed. In other words, whether it's turned on or not. Okay, so you have the product of one gene controlling the expression of another gene. That's epistasis. Now, let me explain this specific example with rat fur color. There's two genes, the B gene and the C gene. The B gene is responsible for producing pigment. And B, unfortunately, can stand for black or brown, but it, in this case it stands for black because black is dominant over brown. So uppercase B is black, lowercase B is brown. All right. So that's the actual color of the pigment is the trait, either black or brown. And that's controlled by the B gene. The C gene, which you can think of as the coloration gene, is the gene whose ultimate product, the protein it produces, is responsible for turning on the B gene. And the C gene's product will turn on the B gene only in the case of dominance in the C, meaning there has to be at least one uppercase C for the B gene to be turned on. All right? And this is why when you look at the Punnett square, if you're a rat that has two lowercase c's, if you're homozygous recessive with respect to the coloration gene, then it doesn't matter what your b's are because that gene is going to be left off. It's not going to get turned on. And therefore you end up making no pigment, which results in white fur. Okay. Notice only these four white ones have two lowercase c's. It doesn't matter what the b's are in these examples. All the other examples, though, have at least one uppercase c. And that's enough because of dominance of uppercase c over lowercase c to have the protein that it produces turn on or help to turn on the b gene. And therefore, when you have at least one uppercase c, then you look at the b's to determine what the color is going to be. Since black is dominant over brown, if there's at least one uppercase B, then it will be black, otherwise it'll be brown. So one, the product of one gene controls the expression of the other gene in epistasis. And notice the unusual ratio of phenotypes. That's not Mendelian ratio, 9:3:4. Okay, now, well, I just went to slide 14, but actually consider this to be slide 13 and a half because I don't have a picture. So I'm not describing what you're looking at yet. But I want to describe another exception to Mendelian genetics, which is called pleiotropy. Pleiotropy is the situation in which one gene determines more than one characteristic, which hasn't been true up to what we've talked about so far, right? It's been one gene, one characteristic. But for pleiotropy, the same gene can simultaneously control more than one characteristic. And even though we're not looking at any pictures, we can think about an example that we've already talked about, which is the human sickle cell disease example. Right? That gene, its normal job is to code for hemoglobin, or at least one of the subunits of hemoglobin. So one characteristic of that corresponds to that gene is the type of hemoglobin. But it also controls whether or not a human has sickle cell disease or can pass it on, which is a totally different characteristic, right? So that's pleiotropy. One gene simultaneously controlling multiple characteristics. Now we can talk about 14, which is an exception called polygenic inheritance. And so when you just look at that phrase, what are we talking about? What does polygenic mean? Right. Poly means many. Genic, gene. So polygenic inheritance is kind of like the inverse of pleiotropy. I just told you that pleiotropy is one gene controlling multiple characteristics. Polygenic inheritance is multiple genes getting together to control one characteristic. And the example in slide 14 being used here is skin color in humans. It's not, there isn't just one skin color gene. There's multiple. And this is pretending as though there are six skin color genes. I actually don't know what the number is, but that's why you have six little dots in each of these boxes. That each dot is either black or white. And speaking of black and white, you know, we use those phrases to describe human skin color all the time, even though there's no such thing as a white person. There's no such thing as a black person. All humans are some shade of reddish brown. Reddishness from the blood and brownness from melanin, the pigment that gets deposited in the skin cells. It's just a matter of how much gets deposited as to where you are on a continuum, meaning a range, a spectrum from between two extremes, very light to very dark. So that's typical of polygenic inheritance. Instead of having just a couple categories of traits, like purple-flowered or white-flowered, but nothing else, there are all kinds of different gradations or values between two extremes. It's on a continuum. And that's because each of however many genes are involved has a contribution to make, and therefore, with the more genes you have, the more possibilities there are. So like I said, this pretends that there are six, even though it might not actually be six. Each one is either black or white, and however many black ones you have determines the overall darkness of the skin in this case. That is polygenic inheritance. All right, now to 15. We're looking at, these are hydrangea, I think, aren't they? Does anyone know what these flowers are? I think they're hydrangea. Doesn't matter, they're flowers, as you can see. And they look identical as far as morphology is concerned. So you would be reasonable to think that these are the same species. They are. You would also, based on what you've learned up to this point, be reasonable in assuming that they are genetically different from each other, which explains why their phenotype is different, right? One of them is blue-flowered, one of them is pink-flowered. That's a reasonable assumption, but in this case, it's wrong. These actually are genetically identical individuals, despite obviously having different phenotypes. And so how is that possible? How can genetically identical individuals have different phenotypes? Well, this makes the point that phenotype, the actual trait, is, of course, partially based on genetics, but not completely. What else matters? What else is a component of an individual's trait?
Environment?
Yes. There's a genetic component to phenotype, and there's an environmental component to phenotype. For instance, if you plant these identical individuals in different pH soils, you can get different color flowers, not because the genes are different. So that's always true. There's always some environmental component to phenotype, but depending on the actual characteristic, it can be a minor component or a major component. We often summarize this, by the way, with just the short phrase, nature versus nurture. I don't know whether you've heard that phrase or not, but nature refers to the actual DNA that you're dealt. That's the genetic component. And nurture refers to how you're brought up. In other words, what environmental conditions you live in. And it's pretty easy to imagine that if you start with identical twins, which are genetically identical, because it's an accident really that happened. A zygote that was supposed to be just one individual splits into two, gets treated as two zygotes. And they both develop into multicellular individuals. So they're genetically identical. Well, if they're separated at birth and live 90 years in drastically different parts of the earth, doing different things, eating different things, they're not going to be identical after 90 years anymore, right? Because there's an environmental component to phenotype. All right. 16. These little tree-like structures, which are family trees, really, genetically are called pedigrees. And for humans, we often, or at least we used to often, do what's called pedigree analysis. It's a bit outdated now, because nowadays it is so easy to actually look directly at a person's DNA, right? For under $100, you can get your own DNA tested if you want to, through one of the many companies that offer the service now. But that's only recently been possible. And so before the days when we could actually sequence DNA and look at it, it was useful to, for various reasons, to know the genotypes of humans, but for multiple reasons, unlike other organisms, we can't subject humans to test crosses, right? You don't say, well, let's figure out what this human's genotype is by mating it to a certain human and then looking at the offspring. First of all, we're not ethically allowed to do that, but also it would take a hell of a long time to get any results, right? So That's what pedigree analysis was designed for, and it's logic game, really. It's based on how dominance works over recessivity, and it uses the useful fact that if you observe someone with a recessive trait, then that means you know the genotype, right? So you can fill in genotypes with pretty good certainty for individuals that have recessive traits. But it also tells you that if a person has the recessive trait and therefore is homozygous recessive, that means each of that person's parents had to have at least one recessive trait in their genotype. And so you can use logic to go back and determine the genotypes for the family tree. That's pedigree analysis. Not done so much anymore because we can directly look at the DNA now. And in 17, we have a couple DNA tests that are shown here side by side. Amniocentesis on the left and chorionic villus sampling on the right. They both accomplish the same thing, which is to sample DNA from an embryo or fetus for the purpose of subjecting that DNA to testing to see whether there are potential problems. The big difference is when they are performed, and that's shown actually in the reverse order. Chorionic villus sampling is done earlier in pregnancy. An early fetus, just after the embryo stage, is when you have a huge placenta, which is very easy to sample these chorionic villi by sucking a little bit out through a tube. And the placenta is a weird organ in a sense because it's partly the property of the mother and partly the property of the fetus. But anyway, it has fetal DNA in it that can then be amplified and tested. Later on, you can do amniocentesis. This is a more developed fetus, as you see, and it's swimming in amniotic fluid. Well, the amniotic fluid contains cells that get sloughed off of the fetus, and so they can be sampled as well. I think that, 18 and 19 together are one big summary slide, just like you're used to having in other chapters. I don't read those to you, but we've covered all of that. So that is the chapter.